understand. So that's a residential cluster.
Call Senate Hess to order. It's right nearly on time. President Mayor, Senator Elkin, Wilkins, Green, Olson, and myself, Dyson. We have a quorum. We are going to take bills in this order today. HB 379, Controlled Substances. We're going to do that for two reasons. First of all, out of consideration of the sponsor who thinks he has another meeting to go to it, too. Then we will take up SB 299. It's our intention to finish any hearings on it today, but not take action on it. And then we will bring back a bill we've had before us, SB 281. And the only reason for doing that is we'd like to get, as an official act of this committee, a committee substitute before us so that it can be considered by the school board, state school board, who is acting this weekend. And then we will, we can have a full discussion and arguments about any of the things contained in the committee substitute. But I would, as a courtesy, like to have get it adopted at least so we can go, it can go in its present form, the committee substitute for the state school board. So, Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do appreciate the opportunity to go first as we are we're having a floor session today, 2 o'clock. But this bill is House Bill 379, and it's known as GHB, or this bill is about a drug known as GHB. GHB is known by many names, but is gaining in popularity as a date rape drug. That's because it's odorless, tasteless, colorless, and it's easy to slip into a drink. And as many of you are probably aware, last summer we had a tragedy where a 16-year-old girl died after consuming this drug or one of its analogs. And the other lady that was a girl that was with her 18-year-old was in a coma. And when I read this in the paper, what stunned me about this case wasn't the nature of the crime. I mean, we've heard of being slipped to Mickey for years and years. But that the drug that was being used was not covered under our current state statutes. And that's because GHB itself is a Schedule IV controlled substance, and the chemical variations or the analogs of it are not listed in statutes at all. So what this bill tries to do is correct this oversight. HB 379 elevates GHB, first of all, as a Class 1, which is at the same level that it's currently recognized at the federal level. And that actually the federal government's had it at that level now since year 2000, so we're a little bit behind the eight ball on this one. And the reason why I think it should be GHB and its various analogs should be at level one is primarily used as a date rape drug. Now there are other industrial uses for this. It's used for ink remover, fishbowl cleaner, and other purposes like that. And the statute does allow for industrial uses of this chemical. So in a nutshell, what we're trying to do here is clean up and update our statutes and send a strong message that GHB and its various analogs are not acceptable and that they are very dangerous, and that hopefully we'll be able to prevent another death, Mr. Chairman. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Martin, I assume that most of these violations are prosecuted in state court as opposed to federal court.
They're correct. Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding. I, with your permission, I can bring my staff up, who's done a lot more research on this than I.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Michael Pulowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. The particular case that brought the issue forward was tried in federal court last year, specifically because the substance wasn't covered under state statute and that they could get a stronger penalty under federal statutes. So I think we'd bring it back to the state to deal with some of these issues.
What I assume. All right. The questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at going from Schedule 4 to Schedule 1, obviously, the higher, the less the number on the schedule, the more addictive these drugs tend to be. Why was it so far down if now all of a sudden it's up at the top level? Why was it?
Mr. Chairman, I think, again, the GHB itself can and has been used for industrial purposes, mm-hmm. and it's not until recently that it's been used for, as a date break pill. And I think that's why it was so low in the past and why we want to bring it up. And the federal government has also recognized that that it's very addictive. And I don't know, again, Mike has done a lot of research on this, but some people just actually drink it to consume themselves rather than drinking alcohol. But again, it's very very addictive in nature. It is used as a daybreak pill primarily because it leaves the system very quickly. After about 3 or 4 hours, it's out of your system. I don't know. Anything I'm missing?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, part of the reason that I believe the state statutes are relatively far behind it is a relatively new drug. It came around in the 80s, and then the analogs have developed since then. But it's also the fact that the use of the drug has changed, as Representative Meyer was stating, whereas before it started off as a steroid supplement for bodybuilders, it gained popularity as a use for a recreational drug. And then when people discovered its effectiveness as a date rape drug, the use changed again. And so as people understand how these drugs can be used, they become more and more dangerous.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm not familiar with what the effects are if somebody used to ingest it orally. Is there amnesia with it? Is there an intoxication where there's a euphoria element to it? Or what exactly happened?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it includes all of those things. It slows the respiratory system. It can slow the heart system. It leads to coma, amnesia, very, very similar to being severely intoxicated. But you only need a very little bit with alcohol. And then it creates a horrible problem for the crime labs and law enforcement because it does leave the system so quickly. So that the next morning someone wakes up and realizes that they can't remember the night before, but then it affects how they are witnesses and all of the issues that relate to that. But
I guess I don't understand how it becomes addictive which are qualified for a Schedule 1 drug if it's one of those things that is not like LSD or some other type of drug you hear on the streets that normally we think of under Schedule 1.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that is true, but at the same time it still is used recreationally by people. And the recreational use, it's not just the addictiveness of it, where it wouldn't necessarily compare to methamphetamines in terms of addictiveness in any way, shape, or form. It is addictive, and then, as you see in your packet, the withdrawals from it are incredibly difficult. And so those reasons, coupled with the way it is used, is what led the feds in 2000 to raise it to a Schedule 1.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what do the people normally die of? Is it cardiac arrest, respiratory arrest, or they go into a coma and then they have a systems failure, or what?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that's correct. Yeah, it's a cardiac arrest and respiratory system failure, as I understand it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm just reading from the backup material here. It says, when ingested, these analogs produce effects such as relaxation, mild euphoria, and drowsiness. Such effects are similar and may resemble the results of alcohol intoxication. Also increased libido, suggestibility, passivity, and amnesia traits that make the users vulnerable to sexual assault and other criminal acts. On awakening or emergency from coma, they may exhibit extreme combativeness, a condition which is also observed in those addicted to GHB. We have online Chris Beheim from the State Crime Lab to answer any questions. Does anybody have questions for Chris? Chris, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. Any comments you'd like to add, sir?
Well, Chairman, the two of the analogs that are listed actually are not presently covered by state law, but when they are ingested, they convert into GHB. That would be the GDL and the DE, 1,4-butanediol. That was one of the reasons why we, on the overdose case, that we had needed to go to federal court, because that was not controlled under the state statute.
Do you have any anything addition to add to the answers that were given to Senator Olson about the mechanisms of the fatalities?
Well, I'm not a medical physiologist, or I don't have expertise in that area. More, from an analytical chemical standpoint. However, the reason I believe it would be a Schedule 1 in the federal statute is because of its high potential for abuse, rather than its addictive property. It would be more the potential for abuse.
All right. Any questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Boeheim, you're with the State Crime Lab, and they're telling us that the sponsor statement says that these metabolites that are the end product of after ingesting this drug are non-detectable, I'm assuming either in the blood or in the urine, 12 hours later? Why is it cleared so fast, either in the liver or through the kidney?
Well, open through the chair. Frankly, we are not involved with toxicology here in the lab for this particular drug. We have to, because it is difficult to detect, it isn't in our screening protocol, and we do need to send it out to an outside laboratory with that expertise. So we're not even equipped to handle it. I know it's not detected in routine toxicological screening, and it needs special protocols.
Okay. I'm assuming, Mr. Boeheim, that they're going out for spectrometry tests?
Yes.
Okay.
But the routine tests that would be conducted, like in a hospital, would not detect this drug or its analog.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Boeheim, and thanks for the work you do. Any other questions, Senator Altman?
And because of the answer to the last question, I guess, and I don't even remember my chemistry classes in high school, but it would seem to me that we might have kind of a break point here that could create problems. We're elevating this drug to a Schedule 1, and yet if it disappears so quickly, and if in fact it's not part of the screening protocols, I mean, how do we find out whether or not it's been used?
Chris?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We actually, if we receive it as a liquid, we can detect it here. In fact, in the overdose case, we had a liquid sample which we analyzed and detected the presence of this analog, the 1,4-butanediol. Then we were able to tell the FBI laboratory, which analyzed the toxicological specimen from the overdose victim, which drug we found, and then they were able to tailor their screening and then detected the GHB.
Okay.
So we can analyze liquid samples here, but we're not set up to do the toxicological screening on biological samples like blood or urine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The day may come you may need to get geared up to do that. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a question for the sponsor. Mm-hmm. As we look at GHB and some of the steroid replacement drugs that need to be out there for some type of adrenal problem, that's where the steroids normally are made, or at least in higher quantities, is there a legal use or a prescribed use where this is the drug of choice in any kind of medical condition that a physician would go ahead and prescribe for?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, yes, there is.
And what is that?
The exact name of it, I'm not sure. I know that it is protected under our controlled substance statutes, under, except as provided in 1730, and that 1730 would protect the actual prescribed use of that. As for the medical use, I'm not entirely sure.
I'm sure there are plenty of other adrenal insufficiency syndromes that are out there, that, but I'm not, I guess I'm not familiar with this drug as it being the drug of choice. One last question, Mr. Chairman. Has the medical community, the physicians in particular, voiced an opinion on moving this, on this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the medical community has not, but the manufacturers have. And it was informal discussions, if anything, and that's what led to the difference from the initial version that was introduced that addressed a broad analog statute to a tailored to the specifically federally recognized analogs and the language for human consumption that you find in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So this battle was fought through on a federal level, and we are following along to put this in state statutes so that we can prosecute in state court. It's my inclination to move the bill, but if there are further questions you have that you want to get answered before we vote on it, we certainly honor those.
No, we don't.
Senator Olson. All right.
Move it up.
Any further discussion? Would you like to make a motion, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would be an honor to do this for the co-chair of finance that I had just had a meeting with this morning. I move that we move this bill out with individual recommendations and the company fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing and none, the bill moves.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to the committee.
That's controlled substances. HB 379. Mine labeled SB 379. That was confusing me for a moment. All right, thank you. We'll now take up SB 299. Senator Seekins.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Senator Ralph Seekins from District D, which is the outskirts of the Fairbanks area that isn't controlled by Senator Wilkin, and the Denali Borough, which spans all the way down to Kentwell from Fairbanks. We have before you Senate Bill 299, and you should have a committee substitute that's, I have to ask Brian, which number is
that? Committee substitute or sponsor substitute?
Sponsor substitute.
The F version?
Foxtrot, yes.
Yes. You'd like that to us to adopt that as our
Yes,
working
I'd
document?
Like to use that as the working document if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Is there objection to the F version being our working document? Seeing none, it is. Go ahead, sir.
You'll see a couple of things in this bill. What this bill is meant to do is to level the playing field in terms of a willing provider. The bill's fairly simple in its scope. It basically is trying to prevent unfair discrimination against a healthcare provider who is willing to meet a health insurer's terms and conditions for participation in the insurer's plan, policy, or contract for health care services. And what it says is if I have a physician who I work with who is not part of the plan or is not part of the policy or contract for that insurance company, that I can, if my physician will meet the same terms and conditions as physician that's under contract, that I'm able to utilize my own physician for that care. And this, I have some folks from the Anchorage Physicians and Surgeons that can give an example of how this might work and exactly how this will be beneficial in providing health care for the people of the state of Alaska and utilizing what is already a fairly limited and short-handed physician supply in the state of Alaska. And if I could, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask we have online to do that?
Mike Hogan.
Is Mike?
Hogan.
Mike Hogan is online, should be online with you there, Mr. Chairman.
And do you want Mr. Hogan to testify?
Yes, if I could.
Mike, can you hear us?
I can, Senator.
Good afternoon to you. Please identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and give us your testimony.
I'm Mike Hogan. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Physicians and Surgeons, and I actually did testify in front of you a couple of weeks ago, and I'm here to answer any questions you might have about the bill.
Yeah. For my sake, Mike, would you kind of summarize your previous testimony, and then we'll go on to questions?
In essence, what this bill would allow the citizens of Alaska to do is to keep their doctor, even if their particular doctor is not within a particular health plan. Their doctor, provided they agree with the health plan's financial terms and they meet the credentialing and licensure requirements of the plan, could not be denied admittance into the plan if they wanted to.
Mike, for the sake of what you're talking about here, what do you mean admitted into the plan? You mean being on some list of acceptable providers?
Exactly.
All right. All right. Don't let me put words in your mouth. I want you to say what it means.
Typically, health plans construct panels of providers. They typically look for a fairly well-rounded plan, but often what happens is various groups may be excluded for whatever reason. And this plan would allow those physicians and other healthcare providers to participate in the plan, provided that they meet the requirements that other participants have met.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, you will notice that
Senator Seekins.
Excuse me. And you'll notice that under on page 2 of the Foxtrot version, if you compared that with the Alpha version that we looked at before, you'll see under subparagraph 2, when we talk about healthcare provider, that a number of terms have been changed. For an example, a hospital was taken out, hospital-based services was taken out, and a respiratory therapist was taken out. Pharmacist is still in there. You can see that a number of, as we got into the definitions of who those providers would be, we did refine that just a little bit based on previous testimony.
Are there questions for Mr. Hogan? Senator Elton.
Either Mr. Hogan or the sponsor. And the sponsor has just referred to the list of different kinds of providers that are in and who are out. And I was hoping we could have a little bit more discussion on the hospital and the hospital-based services, why they were taken out. And also, we're adding in, for example, respiratory therapists, or we're taking out respiratory therapists, but we're leaving in, like, audiologists. I guess I just need to understand why some things are out and why we're adding in marital and family therapists. I mean, how do we get to this list, and how are these decisions made on adding or removing from the list?
Let me get Mr. Holt here, who has worked on this as well, if I can, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly.
Let's go to hospital-based services first.
Let's go to hospital-based services for an example. Mr. Holt, if you want to put yourself on the record.
Brian Hove, staff to Senator Seekins.
Go ahead.
Let's just look at this real quick on the Foxtrot version. The definitions that came to us in the original version, fact of the matter is, really didn't fit our statutes very well. And the drafter of the bill came back and said, you might want to take a look at these things. And so, based on suggestions from the drafter, we changed some language in some of these definitions. We dropped some of them out. So you'll see here on line 11, Foxtrot version, healthcare provider means a state licensed or certified or otherwise authorized. And some of these things that we had in the original one were not state licensed or certified, and so it didn't make a lot of sense in that respect. We dropped those out.
Take a brief at ease. Record. Simon, would you like to come up and sit here?
Come on, Simon.
I don't blame you, Simon.
All right, please continue, Brent.
The hospital and hospital-based services, that was a situation where we could have left it in or we could have taken it out. We had some people that came to us and said, you know, we just as soon be out. And so that's why it's gone.
Senator Elton?
I mean, it seems odd that we take out hospital and we leave in rural health clinic. And I guess I'm wondering how you get to those decisions. I mean, if hospital comes out, why wouldn't rural health clinic come out?
I think we were reacting to some of the requests from the hospitals who felt they were inanimate objects as such, and that they would prefer that the physicians there be included in this bill, but not that the hospitals themselves be included in this bill. And so we said, fine.
Mr. Chair, I just note that that would seem the same with you could use the same argument for clinic.
You could. And I think our intent was to be responsive to the hospitals that requested that they just not be part of the bill as such. I do agree with you. You know, a rural health clinic generally will have licensed professionals that work in that rural health clinic and probably would be covered as such. Although in many cases there, the rural health clinics it isn't being billed by the physician or the physician's assistant or the nurse practitioner who works in that clinic. It's being billed directly by the clinic. You know, there are a number of arguments that we could have on both sides of that thing. But what we basically did was try to be responsive to the health care providers who wanted to be part of or not part of that list. And I do agree with you that we are looking at in the Foxtrot version, there are a couple of inanimate objects in there, community mental health center or clinic is the one that we left in. Other than that, they are people.
Yeah, Senator Elton, at the request of the sponsor, we are not going to pass this bill out today, okay. And it might be able to have some further conversations. And I know this public health director that the state has is very interested in having a very comprehensive public information website where not only all the providers are listed, but how well they are doing in terms of health care, the number of transmission of diseases in the hospital and all those kind of things. And you and I could imagine a circumstance where one hospital in a community might not be doing well on some of those health standards, and a patient might be very interested in going to another one. Anyways, I share your concern, Senator.
Just, I appreciate that, and I appreciate the sponsor has asked that it be held, and maybe staff can get in touch with our office. I mean, I'm interested in why long-term care facility, rural health clinic would be in, hospitals out, and then also just kind of some general information on the list. For example, why we're taking respiratory therapists out but leaving in audiologists. I mean, those are the kind of questions that I have when I look at the list. And it would be great if staff could just let us know.
The respiratory therapists are not regulated in the statutes. Okay. And this is a list of state licensed or certified or otherwise authorized professions. For an example, a speech pathologist probably should be changed to speech-language pathologist. I mean, there were some corrections that we went through in the process. Counselors, but does not mention marital or family therapists. We're trying to make sure that we do get in here the providers that we want to include. The respiratory therapists, as I said, are not regulated under statute. Home health care provider is not a profession licensed or certified by the state. Hospice care is mentioned and defined as hospice, but hospice care providers are not licensed or certified by statute. So we tried to confine this to those places that did want to be in there. Hospitals really didn't want to be in there as such, that were, as it said, healthcare means state licensed, certified, or otherwise authorized. So if the profession fell under state certification or authorization, that's why they're listed. Some of the other professions that were included are not certified or authorized or licensed under state statute. So that we didn't throw anybody in there that isn't. And we had to take some of that out. And, I mean, we wouldn't object if someone wanted to put some of these professions underneath some kind of state control, but they might.
Any further discussion?
Yeah.
Senator Green.
Yeah, I have a question. I'd like to go back to the beginning and kind of understand what the original proposal is between providers and an insurer. What happens to get to the point where you have this privilege or deal between this group of one group of doctors and an insurer or a hospital and an insurer? What is that about? How does it happen and why do they do that?
Mike, did you hear that question?
Yes, Senator.
Mr. Well, Hogan.
I guess a hypothetical. You give a long-term established doctor in the state, for whatever reason that doctor had not participated in a health plan. The health plan has got a fairly robust list of doctors, but that doctor's not on it. That doctor sees more and more patients of his that happen to have that insurance, and he or she makes a determination, you know, for my patient's sake, I want them to be able to continue to see me, so I'm going to sign up for this plan now. The bill would allow that physician to sign up for the plan, provided that the doctor agreed to the financial terms that the other doctors in the plan had to agree to, and provided that that doctor met the licensing and credentialing requirements of the plan. So those patients could continue to see that doctor. They wouldn't be penalized financially with higher co-pays and deductibles for seeing an out-of-network doctor, and the patient's physician relationship to move forward.
Excuse me, Mike. Now I'm talking about before that point. How did that original deal get made between, what was the purpose of the original arrangement between the insurer and the group of original docs that got the, what is this called? Is it a PPO?
It would be preferred physician.
Preferred providers? Physician,
providers.
Okay, why did they do that?
Well, for example, in this state, the largest PPO plan obviously is Blue Cross, and I've been told by many of the physicians I work with that they simply cannot afford not to be in the plan. So the reason that they would sign up for the plan is because they're seeing so many patients come through their door who've got Blue Cross that they feel that they need to sign up for it. There would be in theory, an advantage to the physicians because patients under that plan would be coming to them. There wouldn't be any financial penalties for those patients, and with as many covered lives as a plan like Blue Cross has, it just makes financial sense for them to do it.
Okay, but there's a point there, though, that I'm trying to get on the record that by the insurer working with a select group of doctors or some kind of niche practice or subspecialty or whatever, they agree to provide service to all the clients of insurer X, and they do it at less than 100% of the regular cost. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator. Typically, in Alaska, 90th percentile or 95th percentile.
Okay, and so the reason they think that that's a good arrangement is they know they're going to have the volume that insurer X assures will come through their doors.
That is correct in the case of Blue Cross. Again, in this state, though, we are woefully short of physicians and
I'm not saying it's the right thing to do. I'm just trying to establish why the deal is made.
That is typically why the deal is based, Senator.
Okay. So then if someone else says, well, I'm willing to offer that same service, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, that same service for the same amount of money, and I will accept 100% minus X for every one of those same patients that I see. Is that what this bill does?
Yes, whatever the going discount is in the plan, typically they're boilerplate plans for at least the physicians that I deal with because of lack of bargaining power. Typically the discount is whatever it is, and if a physician under this bill met that requirement or agreed to that discount, they would be included.
But then the value of the original deal is diminished for the original physicians or group that agreed to provide the service, because they no longer have 100% of the clientele of insurer X.
Well, that is the trade-off, and what we're contending is that we're trying to think of the patients and continuity of care, and as we all know in this state, it can be pretty tough to find a doctor. And once you've found one you trust, our feeling is that a contract or lack of being able to get into a contract shouldn't stand in the way of you being able to see your physician.
Okay, so then if every doctor out there who practiced orthopedics said, by gosh, I want to be in that plan, what has happened to the price of the cost of medical care across the state of Alaska?
Well, Senator, we provided you with, I believe in your packet, a letter from Kentucky, from the Environmental and Public Protection Cabinet, who looked at that issue over the long term. Kentucky's had a bill, a law on the books for a while now, and they could not find any long-term impact of these laws on the amount that employers were paying in premiums, for example.
So we haven't reduced what is the going rate or the prevailing rate of, to me, it is nearly like the reverse side of price setting. And a rate setting, and I don't know if that's an artificial way to get to lowering what is considered to be on the open market the price for a fee for service. Is that a bad thing? I don't know, but somehow if you take this to the full, for instance, or full conclusion, everyone's just going to pay 80% of what the going rate is. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Senator Wilkin.
For our person online, Mr. Morgan?
Hogan.
Hogan. Mike, in our packets today, we've been supplied with a couple of letters that I find certainly give me pause, one from Aetna, one from a company called Beach Street Corporation. Excuse me, both of those speak very markedly to the fact that this legislation will drive up the cost of insurance, or could very well drive up the cost of insurance statewide. And in the second, I don't know if you've seen it, but I'm sure Senator Seekins would supply you the Beach Street Corporation letter on page 2, right in the middle of the page, the third paragraph. There's a paragraph that talks about Federal Trade Commission's study or opinion, I guess, in July 2004, a report by the Federal Trade Commission Department of Justice, and that suggests that they were very much against any willing provider legislation. We have what appears to be a truncated version of that study. I wonder two things. Have you read that, and if so, would you have an opinion on what the FTC and the Department of Justice have to say to us as referenced in Beach Street Corporation's letter?
Actually, Senator, I do not have that in front of me, and I haven't seen the Beach Street letter either. So I guess I really can't offer an opinion on it at okay. this point.
Well, yeah, certainly. It might be helpful next time if we talk about this bill again that you take a look at that and see how this legislation may run contrary to what the Federal Trade Commission is suggesting, and also Aetna and the Beach Street Corporation. Thank you.
Jason, do you have Hogan's fax number?
No.
Mr. Hogan?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's a good fax number to get to you?
907-561-7704.
Yeah, maybe we can get this to you right away.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Hogan at this time? All right. We'll go on and take some other public testimony here.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Before we go on, I probably should declare a conflict that I have since I am a licensed medical physician providing health care, and I'm not on any preferred medical provider list.
All right. Thank you. And similarly, my wife's profession is listed here, still on both the alpha and the F version, but she's officially retired, for which I'm grateful since you all gave her the power to have me involuntarily committed for being mentally incompetent, which I objected to. But I don't believe our family has.
4 years at a time.
Yeah. All right. We'll go, let's see, Tom Bryce, do you want to testify, Tom?
Very
quickly. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee. I'll keep it very brief. My name's Tom Bryce. I represent the Alaska District Council of Labor's. That's Labor's Local 942, Local 341, and Public Employees Local 71. Labor's Local 942 and 341 joined together into a health trust, as well as Public Employees Local 71. They administer their own health trust as well. Very briefly, all those members have taken it upon themselves to join together to provide health care coverage for themselves and their fellow employees. We do not purchase insurance. We administer the program, or the trust is ran by members who've decided to take money out of their checks, at least on the private side, and to contribute to the coverage of their, or to address their medical needs. It's our feeling that the bill would hinder our ability to be able to provide the level of coverage that our members need or would like, because we're able to enter into preferred provider agreements and to negotiate specific rates for certain types of services. From our point of view, it comes down to a question of a consumer's choice to a certain degree. We have two ways that members can get health care from the Alaska Labor Health Trust, which is you can go down to urgent care and for $20 get just about any service you need, or you can go to any doctor that you need or use and get the 80-20 plan. In other words, you pay 20% doctor, and the plan pays 20%. Ultimately, it comes down to a question, though, of, you know, having the personal responsibility as the healthcare consumer to have that choice. Consequently, we believe that this will, Senate Bill 299 will minimize or dilute the choices that we'll be able to provide our members. Thank you.
I'm confused, Tom. So any of your members that you represent now have the choice of going to any of the doctors that have signed up for the plan or any of the health providers, and so they have that choice, and I thought I just heard you say that they could go to anybody else and pay the 20% or whatever.
Well,
did I misunderstand?
We have preferred providers as well as we have preferred provider agreements set up, say, with urgent care, the docs in, docs in the box programs, whereby, you know, I get a sore throat, need to go get a shot of penicillin, go down, walk in.
I got that.
That's right. But in addition to that, we also, the program will pay, you know, do a regular traditional 80-20 split with for any other provider.
So this wouldn't change your situation, would it?
It would change the situation in that the preferred provider agreements would not provide be applicable any longer. In other words, it's difficult to go in and negotiate a lower rate with a doctor if you can't suggest that there's going to be a line of volume coming in through their doors. This would take that our ability to negotiate those volumes out.
But indeed, because you're so enlightened, you are already allowing your members, if they want to choose somebody that's not on a provider, to do that. Didn't you just say that?
They can go to somebody else, but they're also going to pay more.
Sure. But under this, as I understand the sponsor, that provider has to agree to that fee schedule. Is
okay. You got two docs, one on the provider, one not on the provider. This bill would say the one that's not on the provider can get the same rates and everything else as the one that is that's on the list, correct? You don't get the same under our system.
You'd have to pay that other choice more.
Mm-hmm.
You are very enlightened in how you do it. Thank you.
I have a question.
Senator Green.
What do you think might be the eventual outcome if you had a preferred provider set up and then all of these people were allowed to become, quote, preferred provider?
Then ultimately there is no preferred provider, and then there is no volume coming into the particular persons to allow them to keep a lower rate, and consequently you're going to see rates increase.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go on to Anchorage, Greg Loudon. Can you hear us, Greg?
Yes, sir, can.
Yeah, please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Greg Loudon. I'm the vice president. Yeah, we're an employee about that. I apologize. I did testify before this committee on February 22nd, so I'll keep my remarks short. Quite frankly, Senator Green expressed a lot of the concerns that we have about this, that the bill will limit the value of that original contract. We did provide the Federal Trade Commission report to the committee after you requested it at our last testimony on February 22nd. So if you don't have that, someone wants to let us know, we'll send it a copy to you again.
No, we have it. Thank you.
Okay. Anyway, that we're against it, the same reasons that were there originally. One thing to add regarding whether this bill needs a fiscal note. Fiscal year 2004, the state's benefit consultant estimated that by changing to a directed PPO as opposed to an open PPO where you allowed choice. It was going to save $1.5 million a year for the state. In this last fiscal year, the estimate was not a dollar figure, but it was a percentage. It was 4% of gross costs, which comes out to almost the exact same amount, $1.5 million a year. Our understanding is that a new health plan is in process right now, and the estimates of savings with the new provider are considerably higher than that. I don't have exact figures, so if someone representing that group's here, I'd encourage them to speak up. But there is a lot of money on the table, and I do believe this will have an impact to the state as well as to the consumers of Alaska.
Are there any questions for Greg? Yeah, thanks, and thanks for providing the information to us. You probably heard we are not going to act on this bill today, so please stay tuned. Rose Cal Meredith, are you there, Rose?
Yes, Cal Meredith, yes.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Rose Cal Meredith. I'm the administrator for the Alaska Senior Health Plan. The premise under which this legislation is being introduced and argued is that individuals buy their own health care. This really isn't true. Out of over $5 billion spent in Alaska last year, only about 5% was paid on individual policies. The average cost per employee is higher in Alaska than it is the rest of the U.S. However, workers pay a smaller share here. Health care spending was almost $8,000 per Alaska in 2005, and spending is increasing at approximately 9% per year. Most health care is funded by employers for their employees. This legislation impacts Alaskan employers directly and negatively. It will increase the already huge share of their budget that health care costs represent. It also impacts their employees directly and negatively. As health care costs continue to increase, employers shift the increase to their employees. What happens then when any willing provider legislation is passed? Employers have no ability to negotiate group discounts with providers, and Ms. Green pointed this out. Employers can only negotiate discounts if they can guarantee volume. With this legislation, they cannot guarantee volume, and costs therefore increase. These increases are then passed on to their employees. Employees' out-of-pocket expenses increase, and in some cases to 100%, as employers are in some cases actually dropping coverage for employees. And so that they're less expensive themselves entirely. This type of legislation has been popular in states where the reaction to rising health care costs was managed care. There is virtually no managed care in Alaska. Therefore, the usual scare tactics that are being used by the proponents of this bill are a smokescreen. This legislation is intended to increase the income of doctors, nothing more. According to a recent ICER study, medical and surgical procedures in Alaska are 18% higher than elsewhere in the U.S. Doctors are paid well here. They don't have to contend with managed care. There are no HMOs here. Some doctors resist signing into networks because they don't want to negotiate lower rates, even for volume. That is their choice. Attempting to regulate this industry through anti-compete legislation is stepping into the past. If we still lived in an economy that heavily regulated industries like back in the 60s and 70s, then this legislation might make sense. But it is anachronistic and serves to protect the income of physicians. This legislation serves to burden employers even more and make it more difficult for them to provide health care to their employees. This legislation impacts my employer's ability to address quality care. By working with smaller groups of hand-picked physicians, my employer is able to provide me direct access to excellent care. My health plan recently introduced a disease management program which works directly with our employees on improving health. With the aid of a personal health coach, the program guides the employee better health by helping them increase their physical activity, develop healthy eating habits, and stop smoking. This legislation would increase the cost of a disease management program by allowing any company to provide these services for our employees. If I were paying for my own health care costs, I would feel strongly that I should have the choice to pick my doctor, regardless of price. After all, I would be paying the bill. If I were paying for my own health care, this legislation, even if passed, would have no impact on me. But I'm not paying for my health care. Just like the vast majority of Alaskans, my employer is paying the bill, and I leave it to my employer to negotiate the best network they can find to keep my and my coworkers' health care costs low so that next year perhaps the increase in the wage package can go into my retirement or my pocket instead of my health care. I certainly do not want to give my raise next year to my doctor. If I were paying my own health care, I would shop around and find the right doctor at the right price. Fortunately, my employer does that for me. As legislators, under the roots of this legislation, you would actually be taking choice away from your constituents, the choice to put money into retirement or into wage increases. This legislation only serves to increase health care costs as it shifts money from the workers' pockets to doctors' pockets. I understand that doctors tend to be big campaign contributors, but your duty is to your constituents, all of them, not just the select few. Please do not pass this piece of legislation out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Rose? All right. Is there anyone else online or here in the room that wants to speak to us on this bill? Anything else you want to say, Senator Seekins, this time? All right. We'll set this bill aside, and we'll take it up at a future date. And then as our last item of business, I would like, Wes, would you come up, please? I'd like the committee, at least for the sake of getting our latest version of 281, is that the F version, the committee substitute that you'd like?
India.
Pardon?
India, version I, isn't it? I believe.
I guess
for the record, Wes Keller.
And I'm going to move that we adapt the I version, and I'll object so that at least give you a quick update on what this does differently that we want to get before the State Board for their comments. The I version says that an enrolling school district will receive the same amount of state revenue as if the school district of residence would have received had the student enrolled in his home district, but only if the enrolling district has a contract with a district of residence that specifies the district of residence is to provide the educational facility and the routine mentoring and supervision, it's called daycare here, of the student and student behavior responsibilities. And if not, the student will be funded the same as a correspondent student at 80% of the funding with no allowance for district cost factors. So that's the major difference in the committee the substitute that we put before you today. And as I said before, if you'll allow us to make this substitute, we'll have a thorough discussion of this and so on after we've gotten a review back from the school board, and when we've finished the legal, got the legal opinions we've asked for. Is there any objection to us adopting the committee substitute or working document, at least temporarily? All right. Thank you for that. And seeing none, we will adopt the CS, the India version for our working document. And thank you. Is there any other business to come before us today? All right. Thank you all. We're adjourned.